Welcome to the 45th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Charlotte, North Carolina for a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal cancers. During the meeting, the faculty shared expert insight on treatment approaches across metastatic colorectal cancer, locally advanced and metastatic pancreatic cancer, advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, neuroendocrine tumors, and advanced gastric cancer. Prior to the start of the summit, we sat down with Jimmy J. Huang, MD, a GI medical oncologist at Levine Cancer Institute. He explained that in metastatic pancreatic cancer, patients can be treated upfront with either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel. Huang added that when it comes to choosing between two frontline options, treatment decisions should be based on efficacy, logistics, and the patient's functional status and comorbidities. In our interview, Huang highlighted key areas of research in pancreatic cancer.
With regards to FOLFIRINOX, gemabraxane, how do people make a decision about the choices there? Are there ways that we can do better? How are we trying to do better? And then also talking about second-line therapy. I think that, that's just something that was inconceivable a decade ago, but I think it's pretty clear now with regards to the data that there is benefit. And so similarly to the first-line therapy then, okay, what are we doing? What should we be doing? And how do could people make decisions? The benefit that we have is that we actually have choices. When all we had was gemcitabine, well, you don't have much of a choice but one size fits all. But now that there are choices between the two, you can make decisions that are based on obviously efficacy, or at least what one may perceive as being differences in efficacy. You can make decisions based on logistics. You can make decisions based on what your patient's functional status, comorbidities may end up being. And the same is true in second line setting. Because there are several different potential options to select for, you can have those discussions with patients about what they value, what kinds of risks are they willing to take for the benefits that the different treatments may potentially bring to the table.
Huang also discussed developments in the paradigm of advanced HCC, which has undergone tremendous transformation over the past 3 years. For nearly a decade, sorafenib had been the only FDA-approved agent available to patients, but several positive trials have brought a wave of new options to consider. Despite this progress, several challenges still exist.
Hepatocellular cancer actually is an area where, fortunately, there's been a lot of development over the course of the last 3 years. In particular, I think recognizing the amount of time it takes to develop some of these products really is development over the course of maybe the last decade or so. But we've gone from a time and a place where sorafenib was the only thing that we can use for nearly a decade to a time where there are alternatives in the first line setting. And as with pancreatic cancer, as I was talking about, in a world where we've gone from a world where second line therapy, treatment beyond sorafenib is none. To one where we have several agents that have been demonstrated to improve survival in comparison to supportive care alone. And then the question becomes of what's the best way of treating that. The interesting thing about all of this is the studies that were performed about the same time, they all got reported about the same time, and now that the drugs are being approved at about the same time. And so there's a lot of scrambling trying to understand what the best way of trying to integrate the different therapies. The approvals for the second line therapies are specifically for patients who've had prior sorafenib. So if a patient's getting a therapy instead of sorafenib initially, what do we do? So it's a very, very interesting question. And then beyond that, there's still the question of how do we integrate it with earlier stage therapy, patients who've gotten resection, patients who've gotten ablation, patients who've gotten chemoembolization. Should we integrate it earlier? And the answer is we don't know for all of them. Fortunately or not, and definitely it's not fortunate, but it works out well in terms of a drug development standpoint, is hepatocellular cancer is actually a relatively common disease. It's not recognized often as such. But it is the third leading cause of cancer-related mortality worldwide. And so there are a lot of patients out there that need the treatment, and that means that there are a lot of patients out there who are potentially amenable to therapy and study.
The field of metastatic colorectal cancer is shifting away from a one-size-fits-all approach to an era of precision medicine with treatment decisions based on disease biology, said Muhammad E. Salem, MD, a medical oncologist at Levine Cancer Institute. There are now effective therapies targeting BRAF mutations, NTRK fusions, and HER2 amplification. With personalized treatment, physicians hope to prolong survival and ultimately turn colon cancer into a chronic disease, Salem told us in our interview.
As you know, metastatic colorectal cancer is a common disease. Every year, about 140,000 get diagnosed with this disease. And until recently, we actually didn't have many treatment options. Usually we use FOLFOX FOLFIRI for first line plus biologics. But once patient progressed on this regimen, we actually didn't have much of option to offer them. Last few years, we start to two things start to happen. One, we start to have more drugs. So, for example, regorafenib got approved back in 2013. Also, Lancer for TAS-102 got approved in 2014 and became available for patient after progression or FOLFOX and FOLFIRI based regimen. But perhaps the other important aspect that we start, I think, to understand the disease better. So I used to tell my patient in the clinic that colorectal cancer is a family name. Yet every patient has his own or her own individual unique features that differentiate them from the others. And I think we start seeing this about colorectal cancer. For example, we now know the right side colorectal cancer is different biologically and even in terms of choice of therapy than the left side of colorectal cancer. So where the tumor arises actually matter and affect the choice of treatment. The other aspect, I think we start now to understand the biology better. So colorectal cancer start to be divided in subgroups. So for example, microsatellite high or in a stable disease, we know there is they are sensitive to immune therapy. So that's perhaps a good option for them.
In the field of gastroenteropancreatic NETs, a lot of excitement has been generated regarding the peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, Lutathera. In the Phase 3 NETTER-1 trial, investigators compared the use of Lutathera with high-dose octreotide in patients with metastatic or locally advanced, inoperable, well-differentiated mid-gut NETs who progressed during treatment with standard-dose octreotide. Initial data showed a significant PFS improvement with the therapy, leading to the January 2018 FDA approval for its use in the treatment of patients with somatostatin receptor-positive NETs. Derek R. McAfee, MD, a radiation oncologist at Levine Cancer Institute, walked us through the benefits of Lutathera and the remaining challenges that need to be addressed.
I think it was a significant unmet need, for a disease that lacked a lot of effective systemic therapies. To have the Phase 3 NETTER trial published and showing such promising and striking results compared to, control arm. The use of radiation isotopes for targeted therapy is something that various places around the world have been working on for many years, and it was encouraging to see this science sort of come to pass to improve outcomes in a significant way. So, in our own practice, what we've seen is a lot of demand for therapy. A lot of patients who didn't have a lot of other options and were metastatic have been reaching out and coming from long distances to receive treatment. So, Lutathera requires a lot of coordination. It definitely requires a team of radiation safety personnel, physics, physician, and work with medical oncologists to make sure that they get the needed octreotide on schedule, and also that we obey sort of the radiation safety precautions for these patients because they are radioactive after treatment. So definitely a team approach is required.
Next, we sat down with Jordan D. Berlin, MD, a professor of cancer research and of medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, who highlighted the current state of treatment in locally advanced resectable pancreatic cancer. He explained that while adjuvant therapy continues to be the standard of care for resectable disease, there has been a shift toward evaluating the use of neoadjuvant therapy in clinical trials.
I think the biggest point right now is that the standard of care, as far as we know, for resectable disease remains adjuvant therapy post-operative, but there's a shift towards looking at neoadjuvant therapy, and I think on clinical trials that's the right thing to do. As for adjuvant therapy, with the most recent data from FOLFIRINOX, for the patients who are eligible for FOLFIRINOX, those less than 80 with an excellent performance status and other factors that were in the clinical trial, modified FOLFIRINOX is the standard of care now. But realize it's modified FOLFIRINOX. The irinotecan dose is reduced, the 5-FU bolus is gone. Never use the 5-FU bolus. There are no other standards for that group of patients. For patients who aren't in as good shape, considerations of gemcitabine or gemcitabine and capecitabine are also reasonable. As for neoadjuvant therapy, it's particularly probably the best thing to use for the patients with locally advanced and or borderline resectable disease, although we say locally advanced never goes to resection, on rare occasion they do. So neoadjuvant therapy is probably the therapy of choice because you have most likely a better chance at an R0 resection.
We ended the night by sitting down with J. Stewart Salmon, MD, a medical oncologist at Levine Cancer Institute, to chat about first, second, and third line treatment options for patients with gastric and GEJ cancer. He told us about how the FDA approval of TAS-102 was the first agent to demonstrate a survival benefit in the third line setting, and how the KEYNOTE-181 study sparked renewed interest in the use of immunotherapy in this space.
There were several seminal papers in the past year that we discussed. The first one was the TAGS study, which looked at trifluridine and tipiracil in the treatment of advanced gastric adenocarcinoma that had progressed on two or more lines of therapy. So this is a third line study, and it was a positive study. Patients had an improved overall survival, and the treatment was well tolerated. We then moved on to discuss anti-HER2 therapy, which included negative studies with the addition of pertuzumab to standard therapy of trastuzumab with platinum and fluoropyrimidine-based therapy in patients with HER2 overexpressed gastric cancer. Unfortunately, the JACOB study was a negative study. The addition of pertuzumab did not improve overall survival. There was improvement in progression-free survival that was statistically significant, and there was improvement in response rate. So there may be a signal of activity that did not meet the standard of statistical significance, and therefore there is, at this point, no role for pertuzumab in the treatment of HER2-amplified gastric cancer. We discussed the role of anti-angiogenic therapy in advanced gastric and gastroesophageal carcinoma. We have only one anti-angiogenic agent approved for the treatment of gastric cancer in the United States. That's ramucirumab, which was based on two large phase three registration studies published in 2014, REGARD and RAINBOW. These studies demonstrated improvement in overall survival when patients were when patients were randomized to ramucirumab versus placebo in the second line setting, and in RAINBOW when patients were randomized to were given paclitaxel with or without ramucirumab in the second line setting. And both those studies met their primary endpoint, and therefore it was approved and has become a standard part of the armamentarium in the United States. There has been one other positive study, that a phase three study that was published, which is the VEGF receptor 2 tyrosine kinase inhibitor apatinib. This drug was improved overall survival as a single agent in the third line setting, and the drug was, but the study was performed in Asia only, and therefore the FDA, understanding that there are big differences in population between Asian patients with gastric cancer and North American patients, has not felt that that is something that would lead to approval in the United States. It is approved for third-line treatment in China. The question, we now have anti-angiogenic therapies available in the United States in the second-line setting, but that, of course, raised the question of could they be used in the first-line setting. Avagast was published several years ago and was a negative study testing bevacizumab in advanced gastric cancer in first-line. More recently, as of about 2 weeks ago, there was a publication testing ramucirumab in that exact same setting. The studies were very similar, and both studies were negative. Therefore, at this point, there is no role for anti-angiogenic therapy in the first line. We then moved on to talk about immunotherapy, and immunotherapy is the exciting new therapy that's become available and has transformed oncology across the board. We in GI felt neglected for a long time, but we now are getting some positive data, and we have options, immunotherapy options in some patients. It appears that patient selection is the most important thing. This past GI ASCO symposium, the biggest news from that meeting was the presentation of the randomized phase 3 study testing pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in the second line setting in patients with esophageal cancer, which included patients with GE junction carcinoma. This was KEYNOTE-181. The study had three co-primary endpoints. They were looking at patients with squamous cell carcinoma. They were looking at patients with very high levels of PD-L1 expression, CPS of greater than or equal to 10. And then they looked also at the overall population as a whole, the intention to treat population. This study was positive in the patients with very high levels of PD-L1 expression. The squamous cell carcinoma population had a non-statistically significant improvement in survival with pembrolizumab compared to chemotherapy. The standard for statistical significance was much more rigorous than we usually consider important based on the trial design with three co-primary endpoints. Nonetheless, the population with very high levels of PD-L1 expression, this result was a positive result, and it appears that patients with very high levels of PD-L1 expression benefit better than chemotherapy in the second line.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 45th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of breast cancer, consider registering for the June 27th State of the Science Summit in New York City. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on July 1st in Atlanta, Georgia, which is focused on lung cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.